begun raising a family. Fern, the other daughter, jumped out of a window of a San Francisco hotel. Perry had ever since tried to believe she slipped, for he'd loved Fern. She was such a sweet person, so artistic, a terrific dancer. And she could sing, too. If she'd ever had any luck at all, with her looks and all, she could have got somewhere, been somebody. It was sad to think of her climbing over a windowsill and falling 15 floors. And there was Jimmy, the older boy. Jimmy, who had one day driven his wife to suicide and killed himself the next. Then he heard Dick say, "Deal me out, baby. I'm a normal." Wasn't that a horse's laugh? But never mind. Let it pass. Deep down, Perry continued, way, way rock bottom, I never thought I could do it. A thing like that. And at once he recognized his error. Dick would, of course, answer by asking, "How about the nigger?" When he'd told Dick that story, it was because he'd wanted Dick's friendship, wanted Dick to respect him, think him hard, as much the masculine type as he had considered Dick to be. And so one day, after they had both read and were discussing a Reader's Digest article entitled, "How Good a Character Detective Are You?" As you wait in a dentist's office or a railway station, try studying the giveaway signs in people around you. Watch the way they walk, for example. A stiff-legged gait can reveal a rigid, unbending personality. A shambling walk, a lack of determination. Perry had said, "I've always been an outstanding character detective. Otherwise, I'd be dead today. Like if I couldn't judge when to trust somebody." You never can much. But I've come to trust you, Dick. You'll see I do, because I'm going to put myself in your power. I'm going to tell you something I never told anybody. Not even Willie J. About the time I fixed the guy. And Perry saw as he went on that Dick was interested. He was really listening. It was a couple of summers ago. Out in Vegas. I was living in this old boarding house. It used to be a fancy cat house. But all the fancy was gone. It was a place they should have torn down 10 years back. Anyway, it was sort of coming down by itself. The cheapest rooms were in the attic, and I lived up there. So did this nigger. His name was King. He was a transient. We were the only two up there. Us and a million cucarachas. King, he wasn't too young, but he'd done road work and other outdoor stuff. He had a good build. He wore glasses, and he read a lot. He never shut his door. Every time I passed by, he was always lying there, buck naked. He was out of work, and said he'd saved a few dollars from his last job. Said he wanted to stay in bed a while, read and fan himself, and drink beer. The stuff he read, it was just junk. Comic books and cowboy junk. He was okay. Sometimes we'd have a beer together, and once he lent me $10. I had no cause to hurt him. But one night we were sitting in the attic. It was so hot you couldn't sleep, so I said, "Come on, King, let's go for a drive." I had an old car I'd stripped and souped and painted silver. The Silver Ghost, I called it. We went for a long drive. Drove way out in the desert. Out there it was cool. We parked and drank a few more beers. King got out of the car, and I followed after him. He didn't see I'd picked up this chain. A bicycle chain I kept under the seat. Actually, I had no real idea to do it till I did it. I hit him across the face. Broke his glasses. I kept right on. Afterward, I didn't feel a thing. I left him there, and never heard a word about it. Maybe nobody ever found him. Just buzzards. There was some truth in the story. Perry had known, under the circumstances stated, a Negro named King. But if the man was dead today, it was none of Perry's doing. He'd never raised a hand against him. For all he knew, King might still be lying abed somewhere, fanning himself and sipping beer. "Or did you? Kill him like you said," Dick asked. Perry was not a gifted liar, or a prolific one. However, once he had told a fiction, he usually stuck by it. "Sure I did. Only, a nigger, it's not the same." Presently he said, "Know what it is that really bugs me? About that other thing? It's just that I don't believe it. That anyone can get away with a thing like that." And he suspected that Dick didn't either. For Dick was at least partly inhabited by Perry's mystical moral apprehensions. Thus, "Now just shut up!" The car was moving. 100 feet ahead, a dog trotted along the side of the road. Dick swerved toward it. It was an old half-dead mongrel, brittle-boned and mangy, and the impact as it met the car was little more than what a bird might make. But Dick was satisfied. "Boy," he said, and it was what he always said after running down a dog, which was something he did whenever the opportunity arose. "Boy, we sure splattered him." Thanksgiving passed, and the pheasant season came to a halt, but not the beautiful Indian summer, with its flow of clear, pure days. The last of the out-of-town newsmen, convinced that the case was never going to be solved, left Garden City. But the case was by no means closed for the people of Finney County, and least of all for those who patronized Holcomb's favorite meeting place, Hartman's Cafe. "Since the trouble started, we've been doing all the business we can handle," Mrs. Hartman said, gazing around her snug domain, every scrap of which was being sat or stood or leaned upon by tobacco-scented, coffee-drinking farmers, farm helpers, and ranch hands. "Just a bunch of old women," added Mrs. Hartman's cousin, Postmistress Claire, who happened to be on the premises. "If it was spring and work to be done, they wouldn't be here. But wheat's in, winter's on the way, they got nothing to do but sit around and scare each other. You know Bill Brown, down to the Telegram? See the editorial he wrote? That one, he called it Another Crime? Said, it's time for everyone to stop wagging loose tongues. Because that's a crime, too, telling plain out lies. But what can you expect? Look around you. Rattlesnakes. Varmints. Rumor mongers. See anything else? Ha! Like dash you do." One rumor originating in Hartman's Cafe involved Taylor Jones, a rancher whose property adjoins River Valley Farm. In the opinion of a good part of the cafe's clientele, Mr. Jones and his family, not the Clutters, were the murderer's intended victims. "It makes harder sense," argued one of those who held this view. "Taylor Jones, he's a richer man than Herb Clutter ever was. Now, pretend the fellow who done it wasn't anyone from hereabouts. Pretend he'd been maybe hired to kill, and all he had was instructions on how to get to the house. Well, it would be mighty easy to make a mistake, take a wrong turn, and end up at Herb's place instead of Taylor's." The Jones theory was much repeated, especially to the Joneses, a dignified and sensible family who refused to be flustered. A lunch counter, a few tables, an alcove harboring a hot grill and an icebox and a radio. That's all there is to Hartman's Cafe. "But our customers like it," says the proprietress. "Got to. Nowhere else for them to go. Lest they drive 7 miles one direction or 15 the other. Anyway, we run a friendly place, and the coffee's good since Mabel came to work." Mabel being Mrs. Helm. "After the tragedy, I said, 'Mabel, now that you're out of a job, why don't you come give me a hand at the cafe? Cook a little. Wait counter.' How it turned out, the only bad feature is everybody comes in here, They pester her with questions about the tragedy. But Mabel's not like Cousin Mert or me. She's shy. Besides, she doesn't know anything special. No more than anybody else. But by and large, the Hartman congregation continued to suspect that Mabel Helm knew a thing or two that she was holding back. And, of course, she did. Dewey had had several conversations with her and had requested that everything they said be kept secret. Particularly, she was not to mention the missing radio or the watch found in Nancy's shoe, which is why she said to Mrs. Archibald William Warren Brown, "Anybody reads the papers knows as much as I do. More. Because I don't read them." Square, squat, in the earlier 40s, an Englishwoman fitted out with an accent almost incoherently upper class, Mrs. Archibald William Warren Brown did not at all resemble the cafe's other frequenters, and seemed, within that setting, like a peacock trapped in a turkey pen. Once, explaining to an acquaintance why she and her husband had abandoned family estates in the north of England, exchanging the hereditary home, the jolliest, oh, the prettiest old priory, for an old and highly unjolly farmhouse on the plains of western Kansas, Mrs. Warren Brown said, "Taxes, my dear. Death duties. Enormous, criminal death duties. That's what drove us out of England. Yes, we left a year ago. Without regrets. None. We love it here. Just adore it. Though, of course, it's very different from our other life. The life we've always known. Paris and Rome. Monte. London. I do occasionally think of London. Though I don't really miss it. The frenzy. And never a cab, and always worrying how one looks. Positively not. We love it here. I suppose some people, those aware of our past, the life we've led, wonder, aren't we the tiniest bit lonely out there in the wheat fields? Out west is where we meant to settle. Wyoming or Nevada. La vraie chose. We hoped when we got there some oil might stick to us. But on our way we stopped to visit friends in Garden City. Friends of friends, actually. But they couldn't have been kinder. Insisted we linger on. And we thought, well, why not? Why not hire a bit of land and start ranching? Or farming? Which is a decision we still haven't come to, whether to ranch or farm. Dr. Austin asked if we didn't find it perhaps too quiet. Actually, no. Actually, I've never known such bedlam. It's noisier than a bomb raid. Train whistles, coyotes, monsters howling the bloody night long. A horrid racket. And since the murders, it seems to bother me more. So many things do. Our house. What an old creaker it is. Mark you, I'm not complaining. Really, it's quite a serviceable house. Has all the mod cons. But oh, how it coughs and grunts. And after dark, when the wind commences, that hateful prairie wind, one hears the most appalling moans. I mean, if one's a bit nervy, one can't help imagining silly things. Dear God. That poor family. No, we never met them. I saw Mr. Clutter once, in the Federal Building. Early in December, in the course of a single afternoon, two of the cafe's steadiest customers announced plans to pack up and leave not merely Finney County, but the state. The first was a tenant farmer who worked for Lester McCoy, a well-known western Kansas landowner and businessman. He said, "I had myself a talk with Mr. McCoy. Tried to let him know what's going on out here in Holcomb and hereabouts. How a body can't sleep. My wife can't sleep, and she won't allow me. So I told Mr. McCoy I like his place fine, but he better hunt up another man. Kinda we're moving on. Down to East Colorado. Maybe then I'll get some rest." The second announcement was made by Mrs. Hideo Ishida, who stopped by the cafe with three of her four red-cheeked children. She lined them up at the counter and told Mrs. Hartman, "Give Bruce a box of Cracker Jack. Bobby wants a Coke. Bonnie Jean? We know how you feel, Bonnie Jean, but come on, have a treat." Bonnie Jean shook her head, and Mrs. Ishida said, "Bonnie Jean's sort of blue. She don't want to leave here. The school here. And all her friends." "Why, say," said Mrs. Hartman, smiling at Bonnie Jean, "that's nothing to be sad over. Transferring from Holcomb to Garden City, huh? Lots more boys." Bonnie Jean said, "You don't understand. Daddy's taking us away. To Nebraska." Bess Hartman looked at the mother, as if expecting her to deny the daughter's allegation. "It's true, Bess," Mrs. Ishida said. "I don't know what to say," said Mrs. Hartman, her voice indignantly astonished and also despairing. The Ishidas were a part of the Holcomb community everyone appreciated. A family likably high-spirited, yet hard-working and neighborly and generous, though they didn't have much to be generous with. Mrs. Ishida said, "We've been talking on it a long time. Hideo, he thinks we can do better somewhere else."
"When you plan to go?"
"Soon as we sell up. But anyway, not before Christmas. On account of a deal we've worked out with the dentist. About Hideo's Christmas present. Me and the kids, we're giving him 3 gold teeth. For Christmas." Mrs. Hartman sighed.
"I don't know what to say. Except I wish you wouldn't. Just up and leave us."
She sighed again.
"Seems like we're losing everybody. One way and another."
"Gosh. You think I want to leave?" Mrs. Ishida said. "Far as people go, this is the nicest place we ever lived. But Hideo, he's the man, and he says we can get a better farm in Nebraska. And I'll tell you something, Bess." Mrs. Ishida attempted a frown, but her plump, round, smooth face could not quite manage it. "We used to argue about it. Then one night I said, 'Okay, you're the boss, let's go.' After what happened to Herb and his family, I felt something around here had come to an end. I mean, personally. For me. And so I quit arguing. I said, 'Okay.'" She dipped a hand into Bruce's box of Cracker Jack. "Gosh, I can't get over it. I can't get it off my mind. I liked Herb. Did you know I was one of the last to see him alive?" "Uh-huh. Me and the kids. We've been to the 4-H meeting in Garden City, and he gave us a ride home. The last thing I said to Herb, I told him how I couldn't imagine his ever being afraid. Then no matter what the situation was, he could talk his way out of it." Thoughtfully, she nibbled a kernel of Cracker Jack, took a swig of Bobby's Coke, then said, "Funny. But you know, Bess, I'll bet he wasn't afraid. I mean, however it happened, I'll bet right up to the last he didn't believe it would. Because it couldn't. Not to him." The sun was blazing. A small boat was riding at anchor in a mild sea. The Estrellita, with 4 persons aboard. Dick, Perry, a young Mexican, and Otto, a rich middle-aged German.
"Please, again," said Otto, and Perry, strumming his guitar, sang in a husky, sweet voice a Smoky Mountain song. "In this world today, while we're living, some folks say the worst of us they can. But when we're dead and in our caskets, they always slip some lilies in our hand. Won't you give me flowers while I'm living?" A week in Mexico City, and then he and Dick had driven south. Cuernavaca, Taxco, Acapulco. And it was in Acapulco, in a jukebox honky-tonk, that they had met the hairy-legged and hardy Otto. Dick had picked him up, but the gentleman, a vacationing Hamburg lawyer, already had a friend, a young native Acapulcan who called himself the Cowboy. "He proved to be a trustworthy person," Perry once said of the Cowboy. "Mean as Judas, some ways, But oh man, a funny boy. A real fast jockey. Dick liked him too. We got on great. The cowboy found for the tattooed drifters a room in the house of an uncle, undertook to improve Perry's Spanish, and shared the benefits of his liaison with the holidaymaker from Hamburg, in whose company and at whose expense they drank and ate and bought women. The host seemed to think his pesos well spent, if only because he relished Dick's jokes. Each day, Otto hired the Estrellita, a deep-sea fishing craft, and the four friends went trolling along the coast. The cowboy skippered the boat. Otto sketched and fished. Perry baited hooks, daydreamed, sang, and sometimes fished. Dick did nothing, only moaned, complained of the motion, lay about sun-drugged and listless like a lizard at siesta. But Perry said, "This is finally it. The way it ought to be." Still, he knew that it couldn't continue, that it was, in fact, destined to stop that very day. The next day, Otto was returning to Germany, and Perry and Dick were driving back to Mexico City, at Dick's insistence. "Sure, baby," he'd said when they were debating the matter. "It's nice and all, with the sun on your back. But the dough's going, going, gone. And after we've sold the car, what have we got left?" The answer was that they had very little, for they had by now mostly disposed of the stuff acquired the day of the Kansas City check-passing spree. The camera, the cufflinks, the television sets. Also, they had sold, to a Mexico City policeman with whom Dick had got acquainted, a pair of binoculars and a gray Zenith portable radio. "What we'll do is, we'll go back to Mex, sell the car, and maybe I can get a garage job. Anyway, it's a better deal up there. Better opportunities. Christ, I sure could use some more of that Inez." Inez was a prostitute who had accosted Dick on the steps of the Palace of Fine Arts in Mexico City. The visit was part of a sightseeing tour taken to please Perry. She was 18, and Dick had promised to marry her. But he had also promised to marry Maria, a woman of 50 who was the widow of a very prominent Mexican banker. They had met in a bar, and the next morning she had paid him the equivalent of $7. "So how about it?" Dick said to Perry. "We'll sell the wagon, find a job, save our dough, and see what happens." As though Perry couldn't predict precisely what would happen. Suppose they got $200 or $300 for the old Chevrolet. Dick, if he knew Dick, and he did, now he did, would spend it right away on vodka and women. While Perry sang, Otto sketched him in a sketchbook. It was a passable likeness, and the artist perceived one not very obvious aspect of the sitter's countenance. Its mischief, an amused, babyish malice that suggested some unkind cupid aiming envenomed arrows. He was naked to the waist. Perry was ashamed to take off his trousers, ashamed to wear swimming trunks, for he was afraid that the sight of his injured legs would disgust people. And so, despite his underwater reveries, all the talk about skin diving, he hadn't once gone into the water. Otto reproduced a number of the tattoos ornamenting the subject's over-muscled chest, arms, and small and calloused but girlish hands. The sketchbook, which Otto gave Perry as a parting gift, contained several drawings of Dick. Nude studies. Otto shut his sketchbook. Perry put down his guitar, and the cowboy raised anchor, started the engine. It was time to go. They were 10 miles out, and the water was darkening. Perry urged Dick to fish. "We may never have another chance," he said. "Chance? To catch a big one?" "Jesus, I've got the bastard kind," Dick said. "I'm sick." Dick often had headaches of migraine intensity. The bastard kind. He thought they were the result of his automobile accident. "Please, baby, let's be very, very quiet." Moments later, Dick had forgotten his pain. He was on his feet, shouting with excitement. Otto and the cowboy were shouting, too. Perry had hooked a big one. 10 feet of soaring, plunging sailfish, it leaped, arched like a rainbow, dived, sank deep, tugged the line taut, rose, flew, fell, rose. An hour passed, and part of another, before the sweat-soaked sportsman reeled it in. There is an old man with an ancient wooden box camera who hangs around the harbor in Acapulco, and when the Estrellita docked, Otto commissioned him to do 6 portraits of Perry posed beside his catch. Technically, the old man's work turned out badly, brown and streaked. Still, they were remarkable photographs, and what made them so was Perry's expression, his look of unflawed fulfillment, of beatitude, as though at last, and as in one of his dreams, a tall yellow bird had hauled him to heaven. One December afternoon, Paul Helm was pruning the patch of floral odds and ends that had entitled Bonnie Clutter to membership in the Garden City Garden Club. It was a melancholy task, for he was reminded of another afternoon when he'd done the same chore. Kenyon had helped him that day, and it was the last time he'd seen Kenyon alive, or Nancy, or any of them. The weeks between had been hard on Mr. Helm. He was in poor health. Poorer than he knew. He had less than 4 months to live. And he was worried about a lot of things. His job, for one. He doubted he would have it much longer. Nobody seemed really to know, but he understood that the girls, Beverly and Eviana, intended to sell the property. Though, as he'd heard one of the boys at the cafe remark, "Ain't nobody gonna buy that spread, long as the mystery lasts." It didn't do to think about. Strangers here, harvesting our land. Mr. Helm minded. He minded for Herb's sake. This was a place, he said, that ought to be kept in a man's family. Once Herb had said to him, "I hope there'll always be a Clutter here, and a Helm too." It was only a year ago Herb had said that. Lord, what was he to do if the farm got sold? He felt too old to fit in somewhere different. Still, he must work, and he wanted to. He wasn't, he said, the kind to kick off his shoes and sit by the stove. And yet it was true that the farm nowadays made him uneasy. The locked house, Nancy's horse forlornly waiting in a field, the odor of windfall apples rotting under the apple trees, and the absence of voices. Kenyon calling Nancy to the telephone, Herb whistling, his glad, "Good morning, Paul." He and Herb had got along grand, never a crossword between them. Why, then, did the men from the sheriff's office continue to question him? Unless they thought he had something to hide. Maybe he ought never to have mentioned the Mexicans. He had informed Al Dewey that at approximately 4 o'clock on Saturday, November 14th, the day of the murders, a pair of Mexicans, one mustachioed and the other pockmarked, appeared at River Valley Farm. Mr. Helm had seen them knock on the door of the office, seen Herb step outside and talk to them on the lawn, and possibly 10 minutes later, watched the strangers walk away, looking sulky. Mr. Helm figured that they had come asking for work and had been told there was none. Unfortunately, though he'd been called upon to recount his version of that day's events many times, he had not spoken of the incident until 2 weeks after the crime, because, as he explained to Dewey, "I just suddenly recalled it." But Dewey and some of the other investigators seemed not to credit his story, and behaved as though it were a tale he'd invented to mislead them. They preferred to believe Bob Johnson, the insurance salesman, who had spent all of Saturday afternoon conferring with Mr. Clutter in the latter's office, and who was absolutely positive that from 2 to 6 he had been Herb's sole visitor. Mr. Helm was equally definite. Mexicans. A mustache. Pockmarks. 4 o'clock. Herb would have told them that he was speaking the truth. Convinced them that he, Paul Helm, was a man who said his prayers and earned his bread. But Herb was gone. Gone. And Bonnie, too. Her bedroom window overlooked the garden, and now and then, usually when she was having a bad spell, Mr. Helm had seen her stand long hours gazing into the garden, as though what she saw bewitched her. "When I was a girl," she had once told a friend, "I was terribly sure trees and flowers were the same as birds or people, that they thought things and talked among themselves, and we could hear them if we really tried. It was just a matter of emptying your head of all other sounds, being very quiet and listening very hard. Sometimes I still believe that. But one can never get quiet enough."
Remembering Bonnie at the window, Mr. Helm looked up as though he expected to see her, a ghost behind the glass. If he had, it could not have amazed him more than what he did, in fact, discern. A hand holding back a curtain, and eyes. But, as he subsequently described it, the sun was hitting that side of the house. It made the window glass waver, shimmeringly twisted what hung beyond it, and by the time Mr. Helm had shielded his eyes, then looked again, the curtains had swung closed. The window was vacant. "My eyes aren't too good, and I wondered if they had played me a trick," he recalled. "But I was pretty darn certain that they hadn't. And I was pretty darn certain it wasn't any spook, because I don't believe in spooks. So who could it be, sneaking around in there, where nobody's got a right to go except the law? And how did they get in, with everything locked up like the radio was advertising tornadoes? That's what I wondered. But I wasn't expecting to find out, not by myself. I dropped what I was doing and cut across the fields to Holcomb. Soon as I got there, I phoned Sheriff Robinson, explained that there was somebody prowling around inside the Clutter House. Well, they came raring right on out. State troopers, the sheriff and his bunch, the KBI fellas, Al Dewey. Just as they were stringing themselves around the place, sort of getting ready for action, the front door opened. Out walked a person who no one present had ever seen before. A man in his middle 30s, dull-eyed, wild-haired, and wearing a hip holster stocked with a .38 caliber pistol. I guess all of us there had the identical idea. This was him, the one who came and killed them, Mr. Helm continued. He didn't make a move. Stood quiet, kinda blinking. They took the gun away and started asking questions. The man's name was Adrian, Jonathan Daniel Adrian. He was on his way to New Mexico, and at present had no fixed address. For what purpose had he broken into the Clutter House, and how, incidentally, had he managed it? He showed them how. He had lifted a lid off a water well and crawled through a pipe tunnel that led into the basement. As for why, he had read about the case and was curious. Just wanted to see what the place looked like. And then, according to Mr. Helm's memory of the episode, somebody asked him was he a hitchhiker, hitchhiking his way to New Mexico. No, he said, he was driving his own car, and it was parked down the lane a piece. So everybody went to look at the car. When they found what was inside it, one of the men, maybe it was Al Dewey, said to him, told this Jonathan Daniel Adrian, "Well, mister, seems like we've got something to discuss." Because inside the car, what they'd found was a 12-gauge shotgun and a hunting knife. A room in a hotel in Mexico City. In the room was an ugly modern bureau with a lavender-tinted mirror, and tucked into a corner of the mirror was a printed warning from the management. Su día termina a las 2 p.m. Your day ends at 2 p.m. Guests, in other words, must vacate the room by the stated hour or expect to be charged another day's rent, a luxury that the present occupants were not contemplating. They wondered only whether they could settle the sum already owed. For everything had evolved as Perry had prophesied. Dick had sold the car, and 3 days later the money, slightly less than $200, had largely vanished.
On the fourth day, Dick had gone out hunting honest work, and that night he had announced to Perry, "Nuts! You know what they pay? What the wages are? For an expert mechanic? $2 a day. Mexico. Honey, I've had it. We got to make it out of here. Back to the States. No, now I'm not going to listen. Diamonds. Buried treasure. Wake up, little boy. There ain't no caskets of gold. No sunken ship. And even if there was, hell, you can't even swim." And the next day, having borrowed money from the richer of his two fiancées, the banker's widow, Dick bought bus tickets that would take them, via San Diego, as far as Barstow, California. "After that," he said, "we walk." Of course, Perry could have struck out on his own, stayed in Mexico, let Dick go where he damn well wanted. Why not? Hadn't he always been a loner, and without any real friends? Except the gray-haired, gray-eyed, and brilliant Willie J. But he was afraid to leave Dick. Merely to consider it made him feel sort of sick, as though he were trying to make up his mind to jump off a train going 99 miles an hour. The basis of his fear, or so he himself seemed to believe, was a newly grown superstitious certainty that whatever had to happen won't happen, as long as he and Dick stick together. Then, too, the severity of Dick's wake-up speech, the belligerence with which he'd proclaimed his theretofore concealed opinion of Perry's dreams and hopes, all this, perversity being what it is, appealed to Perry. Hurt and shocked him, but charmed him, almost revived his former faith in the tough, the totally masculine, the pragmatic, the decisive Dick he'd once allowed to boss him. And so, since a sunrise hour on a chilly Mexico City morning in early December, Perry had been prowling about the unheated hotel room, assembling and packing his possessions. Stealthily, lest he waken the two sleeping shapes lying on one of the room's twin beds. Dick, and the younger of his betrothed's, Inez. There was one belonging of his that need no longer concern him. On their last night in Acapulco, a thief had stolen the Gibson guitar, absconded with it from a waterfront cafe where he, Otto, Dick, and the cowboy had been bidding one another a highly alcoholic goodbye. And Perry was bitter about it. He felt, he later said, real mean and low, explaining, "You have a guitar long enough, like I had that one. Wax and shine it. Fit your voice to it. Treat it like it was a girl you really had some use for. Well, it gets to be kind of holy." But while the purloined guitar presented no ownership problem, his remaining property did. As he and Dick would now be traveling by foot or thumb, they clearly could not carry with them more than a few shirts and socks. The rest of their clothing would have to be shipped. And indeed, Perry had already filled the cardboard carton, putting into it, along with some bits of unlaundered laundry, 2 pairs of boots, 1 pair with soles that left a cat's paw print, the other pair with diamond pattern soles, and addressed it to himself, care of General Delivery, Las Vegas, Nevada. But the big question, and source of heartache, was what to do with his much-loved memorabilia. The 2 huge boxes heavy with books and maps, yellowing letters, song lyrics, poems, and unusual souvenirs, suspenders and a belt fabricated from the skins of Nevada rattlers he himself had slain, an erotic netsuke bought in Kyoto, a petrified dwarf tree also from Japan, the foot of an Alaskan bear. Probably the best solution, at least the best Perry could devise, was to leave the stuff with Jesus. The Jesus he had in mind tended bar in a cafe across the street from the hotel, and was, Perry thought, muy simpático. Definitely someone he could trust to return the boxes on demand. He intended to send for them as soon as he had a fixed address. Still, there were some things too precious to chance losing, so while the lovers drowsed and time dawdled on toward 2 p.m., Perry looked through old letters, photographs, clippings, and selected from them those mementos he meant to take with him. Among them was a badly typed composition entitled A History of My Boy's Life. The author of this manuscript was Perry's father, who, in an effort to help his son obtain a parole from Kansas State Penitentiary, had written it the previous December and mailed it to the Kansas State Parole Board. It was a document that Perry had read at least 100 times, never with indifference. Childhood. Be glad to tell you, as I see it, both good and bad. Yes, Perry Berth was normal. Healthy? Yes. Yes, I was able to care for him properly until my wife turned out to be a disgraceful drunkard when my children were at school age. Happy disposition? Yes and no. Very serious. If mistreated, he never forgets. I also keep my promises and make him do so. My wife was different. We lived in the country. We are all truly outdoor people. I taught my children the golden rule. Live and let live, and in many cases my children would tell on each other when doing wrong, and the guilty one would always admit and come forward, willing for a spanking, and promise to be good, and always done their work quickly and willing so they could be free to play. Always washed themselves first thing in the morning, dress in clean clothes. I was very strict about that. And wrongdoings to others. And if wrong was done to them by other kids, I made them quit playing with them. Our children were no trouble to us as long as we were together. It all started when my wife wanted to go to the city and live a wild life, and ran away to do so. I let her go and said goodbye as she took the car and left me behind. This was during Depression. My children all cried at the top of their voices. She only cussed them, saying they would run away to come to me later. She got mad and then said she would turn the children to hate me, which she did, all but Perry. For the love of my children, after several months, I went to find them, located them in San Francisco, my wife not knowing. I tried to see them in school. My wife had given orders to the teacher not to let me see them. However, I managed to see them while playing in the schoolyard and was surprised when they told me, "Mama told us not to talk to you." All but Perry. He was different. He put his arms around me and wanted to run away with me right then. I told him no. But right after school was out, he ran away to my lawyer's office, Mr. Renzo Turco. I took my boy back to his mother and left the city. Perry later told me. His mother told him to find a new home. While my children were with her, they ran around as they pleased. I understand Perry got into trouble. I wanted her to ask for divorce, which she did after about a year or so. Her drinking and stepping out, living with a young man. I contested the divorce and was granted full custody of the children. I took Perry to my home to live with me. The other children were put in homes, as I could not manage to take them all in my home, and them being part Indian blood, and welfare took care of them as I requested. This was during Depression time. I was working on WPA, very small wages. I owned some property and small home at the time. Perry and I lived together peacefully. My heart was hurt, as I still loved my other children also. So I took to roaming to forget it all. I made a living for us both. I sold my property and we lived in a house car. Perry went to school often as possible. He didn't like school very well. He learns quick and never got into trouble with the other kids. Only when the bully kid picked on him. He was short and stocky, a new kid in school. They tried to mistreat him. They found him willing to fight for his rights. That was the way I raised my kids. I always told them, don't start a fight. If you do, I'll give you a beating when I find out. But if the other kids start a fight, do your best. One time a kid twice his age at school run up and hit him. To his surprise, Perry got him down and gave him a good beating. I had given him some advice in wrestling, as I once used to box and wrestle. The lady principal of the school and all the